You are listening to the cycling podcast at the Giro d'Italia in association with Rafa. Today we are in Black House.
Cozze ci tene, cozze, cozze vicine, non spicudeci cora, cozze ci tene, cozze, cozze vicine, non spicudeci cora, se non mangiano le femmine.
And look, I'm not really happy with Movistar. I think when you look, four GC riders on the deck, they did not have to push the pace then. You know, it wasn't 3 kilometres to go. And it's disappointing. It's disappointing. Everyone knew that Lander was on the deck, Thomas was on the deck, Adam was on the deck. There was no need to turn the screws at that stage. It was 15, 16 kilometres from the finish. And for me, it's pretty poor sportsmanship.
You know, they'll come back and say that they probably didn't know.
But you're pretty. They can say what they want. Everyone's got a television, and everyone knows who was on the deck. So look, everyone wants to win, and the best bike rider won today. But I think it was a pretty poor decision. They could have easily waited. No one was chasing any breaks. It wasn't 1 or 2 k from the finish. It was still a long, long way from the finish, and everyone knew who was on the deck. So I think it was a poor decision on their behalf.
Hello, I'm Lionel Burney, and I'm with Daniel Freeb.
Hello, Lionel.
Well, that was the voice of Matt White, the Orica sports director, probably a very familiar voice to listeners of the podcast now.
Look.
Not a happy bunny, was he?
Look, wasn't the best day for Whitey.
No, well, it wasn't, because his rider, Adam Yates, was one of those who was caught up in a crash. We'll talk about that in the first part of the podcast, but Matt White definitely feels that Movistar took advantage and shouldn't have done.
Where are we, Lionel?
Well, I want to say Blockhouse, but I know from the look on your face that it's wrong to say that.
No, I'm quite happy with that. There's been a bit of confusion about what Blockhouse is, where it is. Blockhouse is an old 19th century structure. I need to consult my notes. A military garrison. Don't really know what a garrison is. It's where soldiers go. And the German general, it was a German general who built it, I think. And again, it's all in my notes, Lionel. And hence the German name. We are on the Majella Massif, which is a huge group of mountains which overlooks the Adriatic in the Abruzzo region. We're just above the Passo Lanciano, which is the mountain pass, underneath the climb, or the summit of the climb referred to as Blockhouse. So, yeah, Lionel.
Well, I mean, it takes your breath away explaining where we are, and the views take your breath away, because look at that. I know it's a bit hazy, but you can see for miles.
You can see the Adriatic.
Yeah, you can see the sea. You can see, there's wooded sections. There's little villages here, there, and everywhere. A stunning view. And also, it's a mountain out of nowhere, isn't it? And the snow is still on the side in little parts of it.
And, Lionel, I think this is almost unique. I mean, it's probably happened before, but at the start today in Montenero di Bisaccia in Molise, you could pretty much see the finish line from the start.
Well, as we approached Blockhouse, I was struck by just how much climbing there was before the official start of the climb. 13.5 or there around kilometres of official climb, but it was dragging up for a long way up to that. And then it was a climb of real changing character, steep in some parts, levels off in
steep
others.
Steep bends, fairly flat, straight sections between the bends, wasn't it?
Some of the bends were very steep. I was worried about our very large Maserati getting around some of those corners. Not because it was struggling for power, because it certainly wasn't, but just because of the angle we were trying to get around with all the crowds and everything.
And again, Lionel, I mean, this was an issue we threatened to revisit at some point in the Giro, in one of our conversations in the car. But the issue of the roadbook, Il Garibaldi, not really conveying the real character of the climb, because if you looked at the Blockhouse profile in the Garibaldi, it looked like a very even gradient. It was sort of 8-10% pretty much all the way up, and it was really nothing like that, was it? And we heard Dave Brailsford yesterday saying that the Giro roadbook, I don't necessarily think it's the fault of the Giro cartographer, the guy who draws the maps and the profiles of the Giro. I think it's probably something that's inherent in the character of Italian roads. It's quite difficult to draw the exact profile of a road that changes gradient five times in the space of 100 metres.
Yeah, and also I heard an interview with Geraint Thomas at the start saying he didn't know an awful lot about the climb. Their attempts to come and look at it in advance was scuppered because it was snowbound here. I thought this really isn't the sort of climb you want to ride blind. As it turned out, unfortunately for Geraint Thomas, that wasn't an issue, and I will explain why now, because stage 9 of the Giro from Montenero di Bisaccia to Blockhouse, it was 149 kilometres, and after 8 days of fairly sedate racing, we really wanted some drama, but perhaps we got the wrong sort of drama. Everything that happened in the first sort of two-thirds or three-quarters of the stages really added nothing to the day. It was just run-of-the-mill stuff because all the breakaway riders were caught before the bottom of the climb, largely thanks to Movistar, who was setting the pace for Nairo Quintana. Then 13.5 kilometres from the finish, on one of the rare bits of dead straight road, it appeared, there was a crash. A police motorbike was parked right on the left-hand edge of the road. All the riders squeezed in. A Sunweb rider, Wilco Kelderman, clipped it, and several people went down, including Geraint Thomas and Mikel Landa of Sky, and Orica's Adam Yates, who was lying third overall. That's why Matt White's so disappointed, because Movistar did not let up the pace. Winner Anacona and Andre Amador were riding really hard. And from that point on the climb, it was a game of steady elimination. With about 9 kilometres to go, the pink jersey Bob Jungels began to labour. Then in order, they went pop, pop, pop. TJ Van Garder and then Ilnur Zakarin. And then it was a race between Quintana, who attacked.
They went snap, crackle, pop like a bowl of Rice Krispies, didn't they?
They did. That's better, isn't it? Yeah, snap, crackle, pop. Sorry. I'll polish and hone these bits over the next few days. Quintana attacked with 6.5 to go, and only Nibali and Pino could go with him. Pino looked really good, I thought, and he launched a counter move. Of the three, Nibali looked the frailest, and so it proved. Quintana went on and won the stage. The chasers were Tom Dumoulin, Bauke Mollema and Domenico Pozzovivo, and that was a good little trio. And in the end, Mollema and Dumoulin actually passed Nibali. So the damage was done for Adam Yates, who lost 4.39, Geraint Thomas, who lost 5.08, and Mikel Landa more than 26 minutes. But Zakarin, Kruiswijk, Jungels and TJ also lost big chunks of time between 2.25 and 3.75 minutes.
Hugely, hugely impressed with the pace at which you did your Tele Tabby. You're like Method Man, you're like Red Man, or you know, you're one of the great rappers from the golden age of gangster rap in the 90s.
I'll take that. Quintana leads overall. Pino and Dumoulin are at 24 seconds. And then, as I said yesterday, the GC would get shaken up like a snow globe, and so it proved. As I said, Kelderman is out of the race. Thomas, really out of contention overall. Just a very quick word for Giuseppe Fonzi, because he's from Pescara. And on the way, we saw lots of trucks with Fonzi written on the side and posters with Fonzi and Giuseppe Fonzi's picture. We speculated maybe Giuseppe Fonzi's family owned some kind of haulage company, and maybe they're the Italian Eddie Stobart.
We will find this out.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm starting to think maybe Fonzi stopped to say hello to everybody en route, because he finished second last at 34 minutes. Poor Matteo Pellucci was last at 35 minutes, but he got through the day, and maybe his injuries can heal up a bit on the rest day. So Quintana in pink, Palanch still in the blue jersey, Gaviria still in Ciclamino, and Davide Formolo of Cannondale is now in the white jersey. Oh. Well, Daniel, I had to have a little lie down there. Maybe a future as a horse racing commentator beckons.
Very impressive. Oh, very impressive line.
You can take
spat
over
those
now.
Lyrics in very impressive fashion. So obviously the focus in the post stage sort of debate was very much on the crash that involved Thomas and Landa. Landa came in, what was it, 26 minutes down? He's out.
Yeah.
KO. And Yates suffered as well. He broke his bike. We'll hear again from Matt White later about exactly what he was having to deal with as he tried to make up time on the final climb. But, you know, were Movistar right to carry on at the same pace that they'd been riding for most of the stage? Should they have waited? Matt White accused him of poor sportsmanship. I asked the Movistar Direct Sportif, José Luis Arrieta, what he made of Matt White's comments after the stage, and here's what he said.
No sé, nosotros veníamos con la carrera lanzada.
The race was on when the crash happened. I don't know. That's Matt White's opinion that it was poor sportsmanship. We didn't start making the race from that point. We'd been pulling on the front for a long time by then. Plus, our riders didn't see anything. They were at the front. Of course, we saw the crash from the team car. It was right there in front of us. Like I said, the race was on at that point. People can have different opinions, but there have been 1,000 crashes in the past when the race has been on. It's not as though we were attacking. We were just executing the plan that we'd had all along.
A 100 kilometers de meta y no hay nada más que decir por mi parte.
Well, Arrieta not impressed with Matt White's comments, but his afternoon could have got an awful lot worse if anyone was watching the coverage of the race on Eurosport. Just as he was about to be interviewed by Ashley House, their finish line reporter, the Movistar team car started rolling back towards what was a very, very steep drop-off. It would have been back down in the valley in seconds, probably in flames, but they managed to stop it from rolling back.
It all got quite eventful there at the finish around the Movistar team bus, because I could see Vicente Garcia Costa tutting at me when I was shaking his head when I was asking Jose Luis Arrieta about whether Movistar should have waited. But Lionel, what is our hot take on this issue? Because we talked about it on the way back to the press room after the finish today. It's such a difficult issue, and Mauro Venier, the Giro director, was just in the press room and he was talking about what the incident that led to Thomas's crash. But he was also being asked about should Movistar have waited, and he said Movistar had been pulling for 100 kilometers. They'd started their collective attack very early on today's stage, and the race was on, as Arrieta says. And where do you draw the line? A puncture is also a racing incident. Should you wait for a puncture? Matt White referred to the fact that there were four. He meant Kelderman as the fourth GC rider that was down. So Yates, Landa, Thomas, Kelderman, and he thought that was reason enough for Movistar to slow down. But what's a GC contender? Adam Yates has never finished on the podium of a Grand Tour. Is he to be considered a contender? Kelderman certainly hasn't. So it's a wasp's nest, isn't it?
It is. I mean, it's so nuanced, and there isn't really a right or wrong answer. I mean, they were on the front already setting the pace. You couldn't tell from watching it whether they lifted that pace. They certainly didn't in the short term, but they were riding hard to set up Quintana and Amador and Anacona. Were putting everything they had into it. But it wasn't a racing incident, was it? That's the problem. If it had been a puncture, if it had been just a regular crash between riders jostling for position, I would say, well, absolutely, definitely no debate. They're not required to stop. But because it was an incident with a police motorbike,
should this be taken out of the rider's hands? Should the commissaire step in at this point? And it's something that I don't think
the car just in front of the group with the red flag comes out.
Well, the safety. What is it called in Formula One? Yeah. The safety flag.
But think back to when Quintana won the Giro and he attacked when the race was effectively neutralised on
history.
The descent. So I mean, even in that scenario,
jumped out of a bush halfway up the climb, wouldn't he?
Even in that scenario, it's very, very difficult to say. Really, the race is on. And to be fair, we'll just hear from Geraint Thomas and get his perspective on what happened. So they obviously, Team Sky, they really suffered the worst of luck today. And you have to think about it and say 6 months of planning preparation, all the millions of pounds that go into running a team, and then an incident where a bike has pulled up in a really daft position. But let's hear from Geraint Thomas and then Dave Brailsford, who were disappointed, but I was have to say remarkably restrained and calm at the finish.
Obviously we were racing for the bottom of the climb, filling the whole road, and next thing I know, just out of nowhere, the guys in front of me went down and clipped the motorbike, and that was it. Yeah, I was down on the floor, and my shoulder was I thought I'd done something bad, and then but as the doc lifted me up, it kind of popped back in and it was okay. But then I obviously had to get a bike and, I was just game over then. I got back on and battled to the finish, but, knew deep down that, there was no coming back from that. I was on the floor for quite a while and then waiting to get a bike and everything. But it's just a shame because that shouldn't happen. I was a race on then. We were racing anyway and, that's just unfortunate that, well, it shouldn't have happened, but that's what happened, and I don't blame them. They were already riding for, a good while before that anyway, so. Well, I don't know, it was obviously sticking out in the road, and we were all fighting for position at the front, and you use every bit of road, you ride, on this bit, there's every centimetre, and, he was just there, just sticking in the road, and somebody hit it, and that was it, a load of us came down.
Well, I think these things happen, don't they, in sport sometimes, and I think you've just got to stay calm, not overreact. You know, the emotion is obviously emotional, but you've got to just, you know, my role here, I think, is to keep the guys calm, assess the situation, and look at how we go on from here. I mean, obviously, it'd have been nice to see how the guys would have got on today. I think we're pretty confident with both Mikel and G and their condition and how they're going to go, but we'll never know. Today, but what we will know is what we do tonight, tomorrow, the next day, and for the rest of the race. And so I think, you know, that as we say, you know, sometimes the goalposts, not if they move, they will move, they do move. And I think then you just got to react and not get too much too bothered. You know they're going to move at times, and you just got to sort of respond properly to it. And you know, a motorbike shouldn't have been there, frankly. I think we all see that, but equally I don't think we need to make you know, I'm sure the guy who was riding a motorbike realises that too. And I'm not sure he'd be feeling too great. So, you know, I think we leave it at that. But I do think we have to go back and have a look at it and just ask the questions. Why was it? Why did it happen? Etc. But we fight on. That's it.
So Thomas there saying that Movistar were already racing very hard for them to stop doing that and sit up and wait. It took 2 minutes or so for Thomas to get back on his feet and get a replacement bike. By then, you know, it's game over anyway, isn't it? So, you know, it's happened. The problem is the positioning of the motorbike. And, you know, as Thomas says, the riders will use all of the road. And, in fact, they'll go off the road if they can gain an advantage, if they can just get a little bit of space. So it was a real dark place.
But it's not the safest place to be. You know, the safest place to be is at the front of the peloton. That's where Nairo Quintana was. That's where Movistar were. And there is an argument that they should be rewarded for that. And, you know, they shouldn't have to pay the penalty for someone else, you know, mincing about in the middle of the bunch.
Well, I don't know about mincing about.
I was being facetious.
Yeah, it was quite a big group, wasn't it? And they were fighting for position, knowing the climb was coming up. But you're absolutely right. People ask us, why do teams spend so long on the front? Why do they put all that work in and tire themselves out? Well, that's the very reason. Yeah.
And there still is risk at the front, but there's less risk. Out of 100 crashes... The number of times when the guys at the front of the peloton are involved, you know, you might only get a handful. And yeah, it was interesting just to hear Mauro Vegna talk about the crash, and I've seen him fairly angry in the past about things that have gone wrong in the Giro, and I thought that maybe he might be angry at that particular policeman and had stopped on the side of the road. He said, well, you know, it was a mistake, but it was also an accident. But he certainly had words with the chief of the police escort.
And to just to put the other side of things as well, you know, the police motorbike riders, they've got a really difficult job. They've got to have eyes everywhere. They're basically making sure the road is closed for the riders. They're making sure that it's safe. They're making sure cars aren't popping out from driveways or junctions or whatever. They've got a full-on job for, you know, today, 3¾ hours. It's hard to blame him for that. It's slightly different to when the press motorcycles and photographer motorcycles and cameras get in the way, because they're, you know, they're potentially influencing a race. And I think we saw a bit of that today. Quintana, when he was attacking on the climb, he had a lot of motorbikes around him. And my feeling is they're just too close, and there needs to be some kind of minimum distance rule.
Needs to be more rules, doesn't there?
I love rules, Daniel.
Hi, I'm Kitty, and I'm the digital marketing manager at Rafa. I started my cycling journey about 4 years ago when I moved to Rafa. I really loved the sport. I rode a lot. I felt like naturally that I was probably going to get better at riding, but actually the difference has been pretty amazing. And it's not just because you're surrounded by other cyclists who are generally just really inspiring people. What was normal to me was a 30k ride at a weekend. What's normal now is 120k ride at the weekend. And so your expectations of yourself go higher because you realise that this is possible.
The Rafa Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kit and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc.
Thank you to Rafa for sponsoring the cycling podcast here at the Giro d'Italia. I'm very glad of my cycling podcast plus Rafa jacket that I'm wearing, because it's chilly up here, isn't it, Daniel?
Extremely, Lionel, extremely.
Nice in the sun, but the air's quite chilly. How high are we, 1800? 1600?
I think we're about 1600 where we are. We're just above the Passo Lanciano.
Right. Well, it was the climb that shaped the race today. Nairo Quintana, now in pink. Perhaps not a surprise,
But absolute devastation behind him.
Devastation behind him, other than two or three names. I think Pinot, Dumoulin and Mollema have done
they
really
did well.
Well,
Nibali
there
as well, to be fair. I mean, I'm thinking more about sort of after about seventh place. So you had Tanner Kanga in seventh place, 2 minutes, 2 seconds. And then after that, the gaps got pretty big and everyone was coming in dribs and drabs. It was a very hard climb, wasn't it? I think Quintana taking 24 seconds off Pinot and Dumoulin is below par. I think it's a 1-0 win at home in the first leg of a Champions League tie. And I think he'll be slightly nervous. I think 40 seconds was about par. I think Dumoulin will take the pink jersey in Montefalco in the wine trial in 2 days.
Yeah, there may be an extra incentive for Tom Dumoulin in the wine trial because he spent a couple of weeks on holiday there. I think it was 2 years ago. July time when the Tour de France was on, says he really enjoyed the region and particularly the wine, so an extra incentive if he needed one.
And he rode extremely impressively today, didn't he? Very smart the way he judged his effort. He, you know, people were slightly skeptical about whether this climb was going to be too hard for him because he's done well in the Vuelta before on shorter climbs, steep climbs. But I think Alessandro Petacchi made a very good point on Rai Television, Italian state television tonight. It was a time trial, effectively. It was probably a 40-minute effort, and that's exactly what Tom Dumoulin is a specialist in. He's also sort of 2 years into this long-term plan. Sunweb, the team, are very good at creating these long-term plans. There are a few teams doing it now. I think Orica also have really long-term plans for their riders to become general classification riders, and that's what Sunweb are doing with Dumoulin, and they've not rushed him, and I think he is now showing real progress, and I think he'll be a step ahead of where he was last year in the Giro, certainly. I don't necessarily think that he's going to be holding on to Quintana's coattails all the way to Milan, but I think he's going to give him some fairly tense moments between now and the start of the final week. I spoke at the finish line to Ike Visbeek, who is a direct sportive of Team Sunweb. Team Sunweb?
That's
Giant?
Right.
Team Sunweb? Giant? No, Team Sunweb. About, well, that team's mixed fortunes today because they lost Wilco Kelderman. He crashed in the now infamous motorbike incident, broke the same finger that he broke in Strade Bianche earlier this year. And Visbeek also talked about Tom Dumoulin's performance.
Yeah, I mean, one of the qualities of Tom that he doesn't get nervous. And we had a plan and he followed it. He didn't do anything crazy. And he stayed focused, and I think he took the maximum out of this climb, and that is compliments for Tom, because I think there were a lot of guys really hot today to do something on this climb, but it's a really hard climb, so I think it was the right tactic to focus on Quintana and ride his own climb.
And the plan was, what, a constant rhythm the whole way up, or did you ride to watts, for example? You know, was he looking at his power meter?
Both yes and no, because in the initial part where it goes fast, you know, he has to be there. I mean, he cannot have them out of sight. So I mean, he for a part you need to be in the red. I mean, there's no that you cannot avoid. But then you need to be very disciplined in finding your rhythm. And in that part, he's good. And on a climb like this where it's this steep, for him it's the right tactic. When it's a little bit less steep, he can be more aggressive.
And you would say on a climb like this, Ike, that par for Quintana would be maybe taking a minute off someone like Tom. He took less than that, so advantage Dumoulin.
Yeah, good climb Dumoulin, but it's still, for me, this is still early. I didn't expect really big gaps between these guys, but in the last week, you need to be there. And the group is now smaller, and it will be every day a fight to stay up there. And for Tom as well, and where you have the opportunity to put time in your competitors, and there's now a few less to look at.
Yeah, I was impressed with Dumoulin, Daniel, because when Quintana took off, he didn't panic. He rode his own pace, rode his own race, and I mean, being such a good time trialist, that's probably not surprising that he was able to use the information he had and measure his effort right to the top. And by the finish, he was coming back. You know, he rode it sort of negative splits, if you like.
Yeah, it was interesting to hear what Ike Visbeek was saying there about Riders, you know, they can and they do judge their efforts on climbs now according to watts and power output, whether it's the power output they're getting in real time or the power output that they know they can sustain based on their training. But they can only really do that after the first 2 or 3 kilometres of a climb, because they simply have to stay at the front for the first 2 or 3 kilometres, so they have to suck up whatever is thrown at them. But thereafter, when the race kind of settles, then they can find a rhythm. And you know, it's a controversial subject, isn't it? Riding, using power meters. I think we discussed Maraveni, the Giro director, not being a fan of that. But increasingly, especially younger riders, they're very conscious of their power outputs and how much they can sustain. I mean, there was a really interesting anecdote from last year's Vuelta on the famous stage to Formigal, where Contador went away at, and he told a Spanish magazine or newspaper in the winter that there was a young rider, and he didn't name the rider, who was coming up to him. I don't think Spanish was this rider's mother tongue, but he kept saying to Contador all throughout the stage, six, six, we need to go at six. And Contador didn't understand what on earth he was talking about. He was wondering whether the rider was referring to time gaps or the address of a good restaurant in the evening, or he had no idea. And then, but this rider kept repeating six, six, six. And then eventually he was so stumped by this, he actually asked the guy, and the rider told him that he meant 6 watts per kilo, which was completely Dutch to Contador. You know, he had no idea how to ride at 6 watts per kilo for 3 hours.
Interesting. I mean, yeah, you can take it to extremes, but whatever method Dumoulin was using, it worked for him. And you know, they all rode up using their strength to the best of their ability. I think Mollema as well. You know, he's another rider who doesn't panic, doesn't get dragged in, gets on a good wheel, and you know, got himself to the top in the most efficient way he possibly could. I have to say though that the man who caught my eye the most was Thibaut Pinot, and not just because he's in all white, which is eye-catching, but he launched a couple of little attacks. He didn't go with Quintana when Quintana made the final move, but I thought he looked good. He looked sprightly, frisky, up for it, and
he's a man of the natural world as well, Lionel, like myself. You know, he phones his father every morning to check on the goats and the sheep. And of course, we had a close encounter with a. It wasn't even a peloton.
It was a sportive of goats.
It was a Grand Fondo of goats. this morning, which held us up for about 10 or 15 minutes. Oh, look who we've got.
Well, hang on. There's a video of that on our Instagram feed, The Cycling Podcast, if anyone wants to see an image of goats and sheep running across the road. I have to say, the sheep dogs were doing a fantastic job herding the sheep across.
Very reminiscent of Winner Anacona, weren't they? And the job that he did today, patrolling herd.
Well, I'm speechless. I mean, we've been joined by Italy's
foremost expert on beaches. Ciro, we're on a mountain. We're almost on top of a mountain. But if you look into the distance there, we can see the Adriatic.
For me, listeners, it's a miracle. The possibility to see the sea by a mountain, it's a miracle. But I have a big news for you. This time, for this my join the podcast, only serious stuff today. No jokes.
Whoa. Okay.
I'm glad to hear it.
Let's kick off. Your mate, or your shadow, Vincenzo Nibali, I was quite encouraged by his performance initially when he was following Quintana. I thought, you know, this is the best Nibali's ridden for quite a long time. But then he faded a bit in the last few kilometers of the climb.
Yes, first of all, as you know, I'm not his shadow. He is my shadow, to be correct. But yes, he was good till 3.5 k to go, and then he was not able to follow Quintana and the other ones. It was interesting that I spoke after the stage to Domenico Pozzovivo. He told me that, in his opinion, Nibali committed a mistake to follow Quintana. Because if he would have had another tactic, maybe he could have arrived with Dumoulin and Pinot. As a matter of fact, I spoke also to Vincenzo Nibali, as usual, and he told me that, in his opinion, he didn't commit a mistake because he did answer to the progression of Quintana. He always did his rhythm, and well, for sure, he was not satisfied, but he said also that the Giro has yet to start.
Wow, very serious. Very serious.
Listeners, I can also be serious. It's true. It's true.
Still no stage win for Italy, though, Ciro, is it? I mean, no.
I spoke 2 days ago, if I'm not, yes, 2 days ago, if I'm not wrong, with Maurizio Fondries, and he told me that maybe this we could also close this Giro till Milan without Italian stage victories. Maybe he could. I could also be agree with him. Why not?
That would be extraordinary for the 100th edition, wouldn't it? No Italian stage winners. Has that ever happened, Ciro?
No. It will be the first time. Certainly, I mean, there are, a lot of stages left, but certainly for Italy it becomes more and more difficult. For example, for sure, an Italia is not supposed to win in the time travel on Tuesday, so we'll have another stage without Italian victory.
But you've got Davide Formolo now in the white jersey, a really good ride by him today. He's well up there. We were looking at that group of 15 and saying he was perhaps the one that might fall out. Quite the opposite. He's still there, looking good.
Yes, we published some days ago a long interview with Ivan Basson on Gazzetta dello Sport. Also, you know very well Ivan Basso, our lighthouse, still our lighthouse. And he told to Gazzetta that in 3 years, Davide Formolo could also win a Giro d'Italia. He's a potential winner, according to Ivan Basso, of a Giro d'Italia in 3 years.
Ciro, last serious subject of the evening, because yesterday you did such a good job when we asked you for some kind of tourist tips, talking about beaches, talking about coastlines, talking about Puglia. I'm interested in your take on Molise. We start in Molise today, one of the smallest and least well-known regions of Italy, but I thought it was absolutely stunningly beautiful.
Yes, Molise is beautiful. It's also that it has been at the set, let's say, of a famous Italian film that earned a lot of millions of euro in the big screen. It's called Sole a Catinelle, but it's not a very famous film, I think, outside Italy, but in Italy it's very famous. Yes, Molise is beautiful, but Daniel, you should know, my opinion, nothing comparable to Sardinia, to Sicily. I miss this region.
And Giro. I'm going to start calling you Giro. Am I right in thinking, so Marovegni, when he designed this Giro, I think he wanted to visit every region of Italy. And I don't think it's been possible, has it? And one of the regions that the Giro is missing is your home region, Campania.
Yes, it's true. It's a pity. But I don't know if all listeners know this. In July, we will have the Tour of Italy for women and the listeners. The final stage on Sunday, 9th of July, will be held in Torre del Greco, my hometown, listeners. And imagine that I could be there because I will be in the Tour de France. My life is hard, listeners.
Oh, he's off mid-sentence tonight. Amazing.
We are listening to the cycling podcast at the Giro d'Italia, supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you to Science in Sport for sponsoring the cycling podcast. If you would like 20% off all their products, go to scienceinsport.com and put in the code CPOD20, CPOD20. There's also quite a special competition coming. Can't give you the details of that just yet, but perhaps in the next podcast on Tuesday after the time trial, I'll be able to reveal the details of that. Going to be a great competition. That sounded a bit like Donald Trump, didn't it? It's going to be the best competition. It's going to be a great competition. I think if you keep an eye on the website, scienceinsport.com/thecyclingpodcast, details may appear on Monday. I'm not terribly sure about that, but it's going to be great. It's going to be great, the best. While I'm plugging things and promoting things, a couple of days ago we did a kilometre zero, great idea, Daniel. Because telephones are dominating our lives, aren't they? Mobile phones, it's been a phenomenon for years now, and we wanted to ask what the effects of mobile phone use, device use, is on riders. So we asked a lot of people about that, and I thought it was quite funny, Joe Dombrowski of Cannondale Drapac picking you up on Twitter this morning, because your phone actually stopped working
today. It's dead. So anyone who's trying to contact me, there's thousands of you who are trying to contact me, No, I'm very much hoping to find an iPhone repair outlet tomorrow in Spoleto.
As a man of the natural world, I'm sure it's not a trouble for you at all. We've also got a kilometre zero coming soon at some point. This is the Giro, you know, it happens on Italian time, really. But it's about the phenomenon of the double, winning the Giro and the Tour de France in the same year.
It's not the Cup and the League. And
no,
the
it's
FA
not.
Cup,
it's not. Well, that would be quite good, wouldn't it? We could talk about that in the car. Can it be done? Who could do it? All those kind of things. And on a similar subject, we have got the next Friends of the Podcast special, which will go live on Tuesday, I think. And that is Richard's interview with Stephen Roach, the Irish rider who won the Giro 30 years ago, 1987. A real battle with his own teammate, Roberto Vicentini, which got pretty testy at times, didn't it? Also, we've got the next episode of the cycling podcast, Féminin, coming too. I think that might be Monday. I did write all this down, but anyway, we've got loads of stuff coming. Keep an eye on the regular feed. Keep an eye on the Friends of the Podcast feed. Daniel, what else do we want to talk about on today's stage?
Well, I was just going to pick up on Thibaut Pinot before we got interrupted by Ciro. Pinot was worried this morning, or the Frances Desjardins was slightly worried about the heat. It's not a heat wave, but it is fairly warm. It's been sort of high 20s, 25 to 30. It's fairly well known now that he doesn't like the heat. He's actually quite interesting. If you ask him about this, he talks about how, for going back generations, his family have lived in the same region of France, in the Vosges. Not exactly an Arctic region, is it? Not exactly subpolar, but he thinks that certainly his family have been conditioned not to like the heat. And they knew, Francis Desjardins had not recce'd this climb, but they knew it was very exposed. They knew there was not much shelter, and they were slightly concerned about that. I think he'd watched, I'm talking about technology, he'd watched videos of the climb on YouTube. But their main concern this morning, Lionel, was getting their hands on a scooter for training tomorrow on the rest day. So before the time trial, Pinot had the idea, or his brother Julien, who was his coach, had decided that they should do some motor pacing. And the problem being that they didn't have a scooter. So this led to slightly panicked scenes at the start this morning, because they'd realised that this was going to be a much more difficult task to locate a scooter than they'd previously envisaged. And
only the French could have trouble locating a scooter in the land of Piaggio and Lambretta.
I said to Julien, why not just find a chap in the street or push him off his Piaggio, and Bob's your uncle. But they found one. They found one now. So
did he say to you, what is this, Bob is your uncle?
No. They found one anyway, and they're staying in a CZ tomorrow. So who knows? We might catch up with them tomorrow. We might. This reminds me, there used to be a chap who lived in Bergamo at the time when there were an awful lot of Italian riders who lived in the city of Bergamo in the north of Italy. And he used to be known as Bob Vespa. And I don't think he had a job, and all he did from Monday to Friday was just motor pace professional riders. Bob Vespa, where is he now?
Nice job. Talking of Pinot, I was looking at Pinot and Quintana's respective time trial records. Pretty similar, but Pinot has really taken a leap forward in the last 18 months, particularly that stage of the Tour de Romandie at Sion, 31 kilometres, I think it was, which he won last year. So the lead that Quintana has over Pinot, 28 seconds, doesn't look all that secure, does it? It's not just Dumoulin that could overtake Quintana in the time trial, but Pinot could as well.
Yeah, he could, Lionel. And, you know, just thinking as well about the riders who had a bit of a hard time today, guys like Geraint Thomas, of course, and also Adam Yates, who I think did a pretty good climb of Blockhouse. He's going to suffer in the time trial, but we heard earlier in the program, from Matt White about the incident, the crash at the start of the Blockhouse climb. Going to hear from Matt White now about Adam Yates' troubles today and also his prospects for the rest of the race.
Well, he's obviously very, very frustrated. He finished the stage with a broken bike and the tyre rubbing on the brakes. So he's got the frame crack right through, and the wheel was rubbing. So, yeah, it is what it is. Yeah, he came at one stage in the climb. He came very close to getting back to the front, And then Movistar had turned the screws up when the crash happened anyway. And he got within 50 metres of the back of the group before he hit another section, and then he never made contact there. But when you look at his bike, he's ridden the bike with a cracked frame all the way through, and his brakes rubbing. This puts a big ding in our chances to arrive on the podium in a couple of weeks, but there's a lot of climbing to go. A lot of stages up for grabs, and I'm sure that he'll finish off in a good place in Milan anyway.
Yeah, there's certainly enough climbing, Daniel, for Adam Yates to pull himself back up the GC, but whether or not he's going to be able to, it's not the distance that he's to Quintana that's the problem, it's that he's also behind all of those time trialists, which he would have been hoping to gain a bit of time on today. It's a shame, it's a real shame. I mean, it is one of those things, you know, maybe I blame myself for longing for incident and controversy, but I didn't want that kind of incident and controversy.
No, and I think, you know, we talked earlier in the program about long-term plans, and this is the next step in a long-term plan for Adam Yates. No one expected him to win the Giro, and I don't think he needs to or will measure his progress in this Giro based on results, based on his finishing position. The important thing for him is that he feels that he's progressed since last year's Tour de France, because I think next year will be the year when he can contend to win these races.
Well, one bonus, if there is a silver lining, is that he's no longer going to have a defensive mindset. He's not going to be, oh, I'm second or third overall, I need to just follow. He can go out all guns blazing when the race reaches the mountains again, and he might be the kind of Mikel Landa from 2015 of the final week. You never know. But Daniel, we've got quite a long drive. We've got to get up to wine country this evening ready for our rest day tomorrow. There won't be a regular episode tomorrow, but there's loads of other stuff to listen to, as I mentioned earlier.
It's the mincing day tomorrow, isn't it?
Well, it's laundry day, and we've got to give the Maserati a clean as well. I mean, it's in pretty good nick, but bright white, gets almost covered in dust.
Almost came a cropper a few times on those Molisano roads, the terrible roads at the moment in certain areas in the south of Italy. Italian roads badly need some repair and investment.
They do. It's, again, the home of the sort of sports car, Maserati, but also other sports cars that are from Italy. And yet the road quality is terrible. I'm not worried about this, Daniel. This is not a scooter, but this motorbike is going to start in a minute. Here we go. Oh, like the firework that didn't go off, isn't it? Let's wrap it up there, Daniel. We'll be back on Tuesday.
See you Tuesday.
A reminder that you can watch the Giro d'Italia live and exclusive on Eurosport and Eurosport Player. UK viewers can also watch highlights of each stage at 10 p.m. on free-to-air channel Quest. There's a special offer for the Eurosport Player, £29.99 for an all-access pass for the rest of 2017. Details of availability, compatible devices and full terms and conditions can be found on the Eurosport Player website, uk.eurosportplayer.com. You've been listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with RAFA. Thanks to them, and thanks to our other sponsors, Science and Sport and Maserati, and to All Press Espresso for supporting our morning show, Kilometre Zero. The music in this episode is by Amara Terra. Thanks to them. Thanks to those who help keep us on the road, in particular David Luxon, Jonathan Rowe, Nick Christian and Simon Gill. And thanks to Alex Adey, who produced this episode.